The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
When I was with the campaign to restore the Statue of Liberty on Ellis Island, we conducted the first ever cause-related marketing campaign with American Express. And I remember wondering at the time what organization, Amex, would do this with next. As I recalled, it turned out to be a young, new organization, one that I had never heard of before, called Share Our Strength. Well, I heard about them then, and I've continued to hear about their remarkable work for nearly 35 years now. And it's a pleasure to have with us tonight someone who's been there for the entire ride. He is Billy Shore, the co-founder and executive chairman of Share Our Strength and No Kid Hungry campaign. Good evening, Billy, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Hey, Denver. Thanks for having me.
You know, I think you can learn a lot about an organization by how it started and what was baked into the DNA of it at its founding. You and your sister, Debbie, started Share Our Strength back in 1984. What was the driving force for you at that time to do this?
Well, the catalyst at the time was the Ethiopian famine, which was this enormous catastrophic event in which hundreds of thousands of people perished. Debbie and I had both worked in politics. We'd worked in Senator Gary Hart's presidential campaign, and I think left politics with the sense that there's a lot of talented people who are not in politics, and we got to find a way to get them involved in public issues as well.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the difference between hunger and food insecurity. I sometimes see it used interchangeably, but they're really different, aren't they?
They are different, and it's very confusing for a lot of people. So we define hunger as kids who are missing meals and not getting the nutrition and the calories that they need to be successful and to thrive. Food insecurity is more of a socioeconomic measure. Mm. Our government measures it once a year through the census, and it's based on questions that families get asked about. Are there times of the month where you feel anxious that you might not be able to feed your family everything you'd like to feed them, or that your grocery money might run out? It's not the same, though, as knowing that certain kids are missing, chronically missing meals.
So after you started Share Our Strength, you raised a good deal of money, and essentially all new money for this field. And we were granting it out to maybe 300-400 organizations, but it was maybe a decade or so ago that you changed course. What did you do to do that?
Well, we had been as you say, we'd been a grant maker to lots of other organizations, and it was very satisfying to everybody, probably except the handful of us who were at the center of the organization, because we were getting up every day and coming in and hoping that we could actually solve an important problem. And so we decided that we should just say that. Let's actually see if there's a part of the hunger issue that we can solve. And we thought, Denver, a lot about the words of a writer named Jonathan Kozol, who says, pick battles that are big enough to matter but small enough to win.
Great words.
And I love that construct because, you know, there's so many things that all of us care about, but there's so many of them are so daunting. When we thought about in our little space, what is big enough to matter but small enough to win, we realized that when it came to kids who are hungry on a chronic basis in the United States, we could solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we made this pivot to, in effect, putting a stake in the ground, saying we're going to end childhood hunger in the United States.
You know, we'd love to discuss workplace culture and change management on this show. And this sounds like that on steroids. Tell us about that shift, how the organization had to change. I mean, for God's sakes, you are now accountable for an outcome. And what were the keys you found in doing this successfully?
Well, it was a big culture management issue. You've really put your finger on it because as a grant maker, we were granting out money. Everybody was happy. Everybody liked that. Everybody said nice things about us. It was very satisfying. But once we said we're going to solve this problem, then we had to put metrics in place to know how we were doing against it. We had to not only have a dashboard for an organization. Almost every individual who worked at Share Our Strength had to be held accountable to certain specific performance goals. And culturally, that was a big change for people. We also needed certain skills that we didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we had skills as a grant maker. We didn't have the advocacy skills, the public policy skills, the legislative skills, working with governors, even the measurement, the performance measurement skills. So we had to, in effect, say to a lot of folks on our team, you need to slide on down the bench a little bit and make room for somebody else.
Yeah.
Not that, you know, you're not important, but we need some things that we just haven't had before. So it was a big change for the organization.
As a leader, any keys to doing something like this successfully?
I think as much transparency as you can possibly bring to it. Just tell people what's on your mind. Be, you know, compassionate but straightforward with people. Somebody once told me they had a formula of when it came to poor performance, zero tolerance but 100% compassion. And when somebody was not performing at Share Our Strength, we tried to be compassionate, but we explained that our first responsibility is to the children that we aspire to serve. And so we've got to build the organization and make sure the organization is set up in a way that it serves that goal.
So now we're focused on No Kid Hungry campaign. What are the long-term impacts of hunger on a child?
The impacts on hunger on a child have everything to do with their growth, their physical growth, their intellectual growth, their ability to do well in school. We were at a school in Virginia recently where the principal told us, you know, kids were coming to this school. This was in Southwest Virginia, the heart of the opioid epidemic. She said, our ability to have kids just take one kernel of anything that we're trying to teach them over the course of 6 or 7 hours, to take that home with them if their primary needs haven't been met, specifically hunger and nutrition, drops down to zero. So we've got to make sure, and as you probably know, Denver, the school lunch and the school breakfast program, that started with generals and admirals after World War II coming to Congress saying our troops were not strong enough to fight effectively. We need to start feeding kids in school. So there's a lot of ramifications of kids not having the health and nutrition they need.
Talking about putting a stake in the ground, you really did that around that school breakfast program. That was created back in 1966, and I guess there may be about 22 million kids who are eligible for either free or reduced price lunch, but it wasn't maybe being optimized to the extent that it should have been. What were some of the things you did around that to make it more productive?
Well, that's exactly right. We saw such an enormous opportunity because 22 million kids were getting a free school lunch, and all 22 million were eligible for breakfast as well and summer meals. But what we learned was that of the 22 million getting lunch, only 9 million, this was 8 years ago, were getting breakfast. And when you think about it, it makes sense. At lunch, kids are already there. Mm-hmm. At breakfast, they need to get there early, so the bus drivers have to change their schedule. The school has to be open. There's the stigma attached to being the kids who go early. But when we realized that it was, in effect, bought and paid for 22 million kids, we started to go to governors around the country. And I remember talking to the governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, and the governor of Denver, Bill Ritter, saying, do you realize that you've left maybe $100 million in Washington that can only be used to buy milk from your dairy farmers and bread from your bakers and supplies from your vendors to feed your own kids?
You know how to get people's attention, don't
you? It got their attention. They were all to a person, they were shocked. They were like, is that possibly true? So it's a little bit of an anomalous situation where, you know, most of what we argue about in this country politically has to do with, well, there's no money for this, there's no money for that, we're going to have to raise taxes to do it. Here, this is an entitlement program that's been around for 50 years, and the money is just sitting there. So it's almost morally irresponsible not to find a way to connect it to the kids who need it.
You know, I was speaking recently to Josh Wright, who is the executive director of Ideas 42, and we were talking about how these little changes can really have profound changes in behavior. And in this particular case, breakfast was served early in the cafeteria. Tell us what you did to change that and how it impacted this program.
Well, we learned of a couple places around the country that were moving breakfast from the cafeteria, where you have to get there early, to the first 10 minutes of first period, or a grab-and-go breakfast between first and second period. So think of it under the category of breakfast after the bell or breakfast in the classroom. What I love about it, and we didn't invent the change, but I think we invented the notion of scaling the change.
Uh-huh.
And when we heard about it, we realized that here's a program that's been operating the same way for over 50 years, and with very little expense involved. To move it from the cafeteria to the classroom, you might need some carts on wheels, you might need some insulated trays, you might need some different supplies for the classroom than you need in the cafeteria. But it was such a small change that had such an enormous impact. So we've added over 3 million kids to the school breakfast program in the last 6 years, and we've seen their math scores go up, we've seen their attendance improve, we've seen their tardiness and their visits to the nurse's office go down. It's really had a very powerful impact, and we're not done yet. We've still got quite a ways to go.
Absolutely, but that's really profound. Well, let's get past the school year. Now it's summer. And only about 18% of kids who qualify for school meals are getting free summer meals. How do you handle that? What's been your approach?
Well, summer's even harder to solve. So when the summer meals program was created, I think the creators thought it was going to be implemented during summer school in the public schools. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of public schools have, you know, basically reduced their summer school programs for budgetary reasons. And so now we have to create this kind of patchwork quilt of Boys and Girls Clubs, Parks and Recreation Department, church basement that will sign up and be sponsors for the summer meals program. But that's a hard thing for them to do. They have to suffer through all the federal paperwork and the reimbursement rate and the time lag. But we've added tens of thousands of summer meal sites, and we're working on some legislative changes to try and improve the program as well.
And you also have a text, don't you?
Yeah, we have a texting program where if you text a certain number, I don't have it on the top of my head, but when you text it, what comes straight to your phone or your mobile device is the summer meal site closest to you. It's really worked fabulously well.
That is fantastic. You know, as part of the No Kid Hungry campaign, you have a program called Cooking Matters. Well, now, what is that about?
Well, the idea behind Cooking Matters is that if you're of low income, it's and on a fixed budget, it's really important to know how to use the foods that you get in ways that are going to be affordable, economic, tasty for your kids. So we actually take moms on a six-week course and teach them the best things to do with different food products. We take them into supermarkets so that they can understand the nutrition label and how to read it, unit pricing, how to make the best decisions for their family. So sometimes that education can be just as powerful as any grant that we can make to them. And it's empowering. They actually know how to do the things that they want to do, which is make healthy meals for their kids.
You know, and looking at your annual report, I saw some of your numbers. And Billy, you have some very impressive numbers of what you've been able to do since you started this program. Why don't you share some of those with us?
Yeah, well, I think the key things for us have been to add kids to the school breakfast program in the numbers that we have. And that's, as I say, about 3 million kids. We've also, you know, we're operating in all 50 states. We've got 900 at some community partners. We've helped serve over 775 million meals. I think the, you know, important thing to understand, though, is where that puts us against the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, honestly, we're about halfway there. We've added 3 million kids to school breakfast. The number one priority for everybody who's affiliated with our organization in any way is to add that last 3 million. We've got 3 million more to go. Not every kid should have school breakfast at school. Some kids are going to eat at home with their mom and dad, which is great. But about 3 million kids more need to be added to the program, and we'll get that done in the next 5 years.
If your goal is to end childhood hunger, how do you define that?
We're going to measure it in the most simple common sense way that I can think of, which is kids having 3 meals a day.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we're finding now is that the number of kids who are food insecure, whose families present and say we're struggling to get all the food that we need for our kids, the number of kids who personally experience that is now less than 1 in 10.
Hmm.
So that's a big drop. But about 1 in 6 kids live in homes where there's food insecurity. So mom or dad might be sacrificing or skipping a meal to make sure that the kids are getting it. That's not good for kids either.
No,
so we've got to get to that. And one of the hardest things that we're going to have to figure out is how to build the public will, not just to feed kids, but to support the families that they're in so the kids can be prevented from being hungry in the first place.
Fantastic. You know, I mentioned in the opening you did that cause-related marketing campaign with American Express, and that was really the first signs that you were going to be incredibly entrepreneurial in the way you go about raising money. What are some of the other things that Share Our Strength has done?
Well, we've tried lots of ways to engage different partners in what we think of as win-win partnerships that, in effect, create wealth. You know, one of the first things that struck me as I got more familiar with the nonprofit sector was that, you know, even if we were the best at what we did, there just aren't enough charitable dollars to go around to solve the problem. And we didn't want to think of ourselves competing for a share of a finite pie. We wanted to see if we could make that pie grow. And so we literally started to create partnerships with companies,
mm-hmm.
particularly corporate partners, that would be good for them and be good for us. So I'll give you a great current example. We've got a campaign, a partnership with Williams-Sonoma.
Yep.
And we've had different celebrities around the country, from Jeff Bridges to Kristen Bell to Gwen Stefani, to Hunter Pence with the San Francisco Giants. We've had them design spatulas. they do artwork on the spatulas. Williams-Sonoma sells those in all of their stores over about a 60 to 75-day period, and the proceeds come to Share Our Strength. Now, there's been a tremendous amount of publicity, both conventional press and social media, around it. People are being driven into the Williams-Sonoma stores. They're seeing this good publicity. Williams-Sonoma's employees feel good about it, as they should. And Share Our Strength will end up generating literally several million dollars, all of which will go towards this effort to engage kids in school breakfast. So when we find those types of win-win partnerships, we think of ourselves as not just redistributing wealth, but creating it. And we call it community wealth because it goes back into the community.
Another wonderful thing about that kind of wealth is that so much of that money is unrestricted and comes to the organization that really lets you leverage it in creative ways instead of having your hands tied with a program grant.
That's right. I think the two advantages are there's no strings attached to it, so we can use it as strategically as possible. And sometimes, as you know, organizations that have to depend on traditional philanthropy end up sometimes being pushed into what I think of as mission creep. The grant maker will say, well, we really want you to work not just on hunger, but on obesity. And we'll say, well, that's great, but you know, there are organizations that work on obesity, and we're a hunger organization, although in fact the two are related. But the point is, grant makers can be, you know, overly influential. And so these types of dollars have no strings attached, and they're not competing with brother and sister organizations for finite charitable dollars. So we'd never want to be in the position of, you know, if we were applying for a grant that the food bank of the city of New York was
one or the other.
Yeah,
right.
Why, you know, we just want to be actually increasing the amount of money available to the food bank, not dividing it with them.
Well, and speaking of celebrities, you almost pioneered the idea of the celebrity chef. Tell us a little bit about the work you've done with chefs.
Well, when we very first started the organization, we asked ourselves, who understands the importance of feeding people and who would have an interest in feeding people that can't afford meals? And we thought about chefs and restaurateurs, and some of them got that right away. Some of them didn't. But we decided that we would really try to create assemble a market around chefs and their connection to feeding people. So today we've ended up, and was you know, a little bit hard rock mining at first, cold calling and so forth, but today we've ended up with about 20,000 chefs and restaurateurs who are involved in lots of community things, but many of them feel their first connection is to the issue of hunger. And we started doing this right at the time, this was luck more than anything else, at which chefs started to become celebrities. And there started to be a Food Network and a cooking channel and TV shows.
Books.
And books. And, you know, now Jose Andreas, who's doing work on hurricane relief as we speak and did the great work in Puerto Rico, he actually, when he first came to Washington, Denver, the first thing that he got involved in was our Cooking Matters program. He was looking for a way to get involved in the community. And he talks about that all the time as kind of the window through which he got connected to philanthropy. But everybody from Jose Andreas to Alice Waters at Chez Panisse in California, Danny Meyer in New York City, and the Shake Shacks, they've all become, you know, kind of the superstars of our anti-hunger effort.
Yeah, and now you got them on bicycles too, right?
And now we've got a program for chefs to ride called Chef Cycle. And this was a program in which chefs came up with it, actually. They said to us, we want to really challenge ourselves to do something physically transformative that will have an impact on other people. So we created a 300-mile ride. We do it out of Santa Rosa, California, once a year. It is a real push, but we've got hundreds of riders, and it's raised, I'm going to say, probably about $4 million so far.
Great. Speaking of chefs, you host a podcast called Ed, Passion, and Stir. Big chefs, big ideas. Tell us about your podcast.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you brought it up because it's been a lot of fun. And the idea is to have a conversation every week with somebody from the food world and somebody from kind of the social justice or public policy world. The idea is that food is connected to so many issues that we care about. Now, there's a whole community of foodies who just want to know what the greatest new restaurant is or the best new recipe. But food is also connected to not just, as we've talked about, issues like hunger and poverty and our health and our educational achievement. It's connected to our environment in very big ways, to sustainability, to climate change, the way we harvest, the way we grow, our agricultural practices. All this connected to food. So we've had some really great conversations. Last week, for example, we had former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell and Danny Meyer talking about a whole set of issues, in many cases focusing in that conversation on immigration. The restaurant industry deals with these immigration issues almost more than any other industry. And so we look for these kind of commonalities or intersections. Later this week, we'll have a podcast with Will Gadara, who's from 11 Madison Park, which is a Michelin star and New York Times four-star restaurant in New York, and a woman named Kat Kinsman, who started an organization and a website called Chefs with Issues, and it's about chefs needing to be healthier. So we talk about lots of issues related to food, and it's on iTunes, Ad Passion, and Stir.
Very good. Very entertaining and very informative. Well, food is also attached and associated with government and politics, and I've got a lot of thoughts about that, I'm sure. Let's start with this, though. Tax-exempt nonprofits, they can't be partisan. And I think as a result, many of them just sit on the sidelines because they're afraid to do anything, and that includes right before the midterm elections. You believe they need to get off those sidelines and a little bit more into the game. What would you like to see them do?
Well, you know, whatever the nonprofit might be, whatever issue they're involved in, whether it's hunger or the environment or education or the arts, that issue is going to be impacted by public policy and by who's elected and by who controls Congress. Now, they can't be partisan, but they can be political. And so, for example, at Share Our Strength, we work with lots of different governors and members of Congress of both parties, and we're hoping that our supporters will understand the need to, at a minimum, get out and vote. As you know, only about half of eligible Americans actually vote.
52% or something, yeah.
Yeah. I was with Governor Bullock from Montana, Steve Bullock, and he was saying that if young people voted at the same proportion that seniors did, millennials would decide every election. So I think that if we can increase the turnout, we'll certainly have a more engaged citizenry. We'll probably have better political leaders as well.
I think you're right. You know, you collect beautiful note cards, Billy, and you like to use them for personal letters. Those are the kind of things you send with a stamp.
You're gonna have to tell me how you know that. You do very good research.
It's not because you sent me a letter, I'll tell you that. How do people respond to receiving these letters, and are there any other personal touches you're very fond of?
Well, I think kind of breaking through the clutter of modern day communications and email and all of the other things and having some personal touch, I just think it not only gets people's attention, but it forces me to be more personal in my outreach. And I just, I guess I'm like anybody else. I'm eager and I guess just eager to connect with people on a personal level. And I feel like so much of what we want to do at Share Our Strength, if it's transactional, it's not sustainable.
Yeah.
If there's a relationship that's built, a genuine, authentic relationship, then you're going to be in it together for the long haul.
Let me close with this, Billy. You've been a very astute observer and commentator on the social good and nonprofit sector for several decades now. As you assess it, and in the context of a very fast-changing world, what do you believe the sector is doing well, and what do you think it really needs to improve upon?
Well, I think the nonprofit sector, I think, does a good job of attracting impressive people to it, people who really want to make a difference. Increasingly, it's been a place where you can actually have a career in the nonprofit sector. I think the sector has been building capacity. Fundamentally, though, I think the sector still needs to be more bold. I always feel like the greatest failures are not the failures that we think of where we don't have enough money or we didn't have enough time or we didn't have the right strategy. They're usually failures of imagination. Mm-hmm. And if we don't aim high enough, for example, right now in the anti-hunger community, we're engaged in a number of kind of defensive battles to make sure the SNAP food stamp program doesn't get cut and to make sure that the summer meals program doesn't go away. We need to be thinking beyond that, though. We should have an agenda. For example, a new Congress might be sworn in. It might be a Congress controlled by the Democratic Party. We should have an agenda of big ideas for them about how to deal with some of these issues. And I think we've all gotten a little just too timid. And that, to me, is the greatest failing of the nonprofit sector. And to some extent, the progressive community that tends to populate it.
Yeah, I think it's also a failure of society. We're all captivated by what's happening at the moment.
Right.
Not what happened before and not what's going to happen,
but what's
taking up all the oxygen at this very second. Well, Billy Shore, the co-founder and executive chairman of Share Our Strength and the No Kid Hungry campaign, thank you so much for being here. Now, I know it's going to take everyone to solve childhood hunger. So how can people get involved? How can they financially help out? And how can they learn more about your organization?
Well, the thing I love about the issue of hunger, Denver, is there's a role for everybody to play in it. This is not like trying to come up with a vaccine for some disease or trying to solve nuclear proliferation. Everybody can be involved. They can donate funds. They can volunteer. They can be advocates. They can get involved in the schools in their neighborhood. So if you go to nokidhungry.org or shareourstrength.org, you find lots of ways to engage, and that's probably the best way. Also, everybody has a local food bank in their community, a local advocacy organization, and we'd be glad to connect people to those as well.
And give a listen to Ed, Passion, and Stir. Well, thanks, Billy. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.